Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm Craig Venter, head of the J. Craig Venter Institute. I'd like to acknowledge first just a few people in the audience before we jump into things and to identify the panel. But first and foremost, Barbara Jasny, the one of the editors of Science, and this is her 19th year of editing our papers. You'd think we'd get them right by now, but they still need editing after all her work. So, Barbara, we're delighted to have you here representing Science and AAAS. So to my left is Dan Gibson, Ham Smith, Clyde Hutchison, John Glass, Carol Lettigue, flew in from France today, and Bob Friedman, who's head of our policy panel. Also, we have the directors of the two Venter Institute campuses. Bob Friedman's the director of the La Jolla campus, and Karen Nelson here in front of me is head of the Rockville campus. We also have several board members here. Ham Smith is a board member. Erling Norby is here. He flew in from Stockholm this morning as the vice chairman of our board. Dean Ornish, the famous diet doctor of all time, is here with us. Ted Danforth and Bill Harmon. We're delighted all of them are with us. And then on the synthetic genomics side, Ham Smith and I and Dave Kiernan and Juan Enriquez started synthetic genomics a few years ago to have the means and part of funding this research. So we have several directors, including our initial investor, Alfonso Romo, who just flew in from Mexico, Dave Kiernan, Juan Enriquez. So we're delighted to have all of you here. Also, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge John Brockman, my book editor. So we're here today to announce the first synthetic cell, a cell made by starting with the digital code in the computer, building the chromosome from four bottles of chemicals, assembling that chromosome in yeast, transplanting it into a recipient bacterial cell, and transforming that cell into a new bacterial species. So this is the first self-replicating species that we've had on the planet whose parent is a computer. It also is the first species to have its own website encoded in its genetic code. But we'll talk more about the watermarks in a minute. This is a project that had its inception 15 years ago when our team we called the Institute Tiger, including Ham Smith and Clyde Hutchison, myself, were involved in sequencing the first two genomes in history. Ham and I did Haemophilus influenzae, and then Clyde brought to us the smallest genome of a self-replicating organism, that of Mycoplasma genitalium. And as soon as we had these two sequences, we thought, if this is supposed to be the smallest genome of a self-replicating species, could there be even a smaller genome? Could we understand the basis of cellular life at the genetic level? It's been a 15-year quest just to get to the starting point now to be able to answer those questions. Because it's very difficult to eliminate multiple genes from a cell, you can only do them one at a time, we decided early on that we had to take a synthetic route, even though nobody had been there before, to see if we could synthesize the bacterial chromosome so we could actually vary the gene content to understand the essential genes for life. That started our 15-year quest to get here. Before we did the first experiments, we actually asked Art Kaplan's team, then at the University of Pennsylvania, to undertake a review of whether what the risks, the challenges, the ethics around creating new species in the laboratory were, because it hadn't been done before. They spent about 2 years reviewing that independently and published their results in Science in 1999. Ham and I took a 2 years off as a side project to sequence the human genome, but as soon as that was done, we got back to the task at hand. In 2002, we started a new institute, the Institute for Biological Energy Alternatives, where we set out two goals. One, to understand the impact of our technology on the environment and how to understand the environment better, and two, to start down this process of making synthetic life to understand basic life. In 2003, we published our first success. So Ham Smith and Clyde Hutchison developed some new methods for making error-free DNA at a small level. Our first task was a 5,000-letter code bacteriophage, a virus that attacks only E. coli. So that was the phage PhyX-174, which was chosen for historical reasons. It was the first DNA phage, DNA virus, DNA genome that was actually sequenced by Fred Sanger and colleagues that also included Clyde Hutchison back in the 70s. So once we realized that we could make 5,000 base pair viral size pieces, we thought we at least had the means then to try and make serially lots of these pieces to be able to eventually assemble them together to make a complete bacterial chromosome. It was a long route, and Dan Gibson will walk us through the methods that the team developed for synthesizing this megabase chromosome, so substantially larger than we even thought we would go after initially. So there were several steps to this. There were two sides. We had to solve the chemistry for making large DNA molecules, and we had to solve the biological side of how, if we had this new chemical entity, how would we boot it up, activate it in a recipient cell. So we had two teams working in parallel, one team on the chemistry and the other on trying to be able to transplant entire chromosomes to get new cells. So John Glass and Carol Lepig were key in the biological side of the genome transplantation, and Clyde, John and Ham, a team actually led by Ham, led the synthesis side. When we started this out, we thought the synthesis would be the biggest problem, which is why we chose the smallest genome. And some of you have noticed that we switched from the smallest genome to a much larger one, and we can walk through the reasons for that, but basically the small cell took on the order of 1 to 2 months to get results from, whereas the larger, faster-growing cell takes only 2 days. So there's only so many cycles we could go through in a year at 6 months, 6 weeks per cycle. And you should know that basically 99% plus of our experiments failed. So this was a debugging, problem-solving scenario from the beginning, because there was no recipe of how to get there. So one of the most important publications we had was in 2007. Carol Lepig led the effort to actually transplant a bacterial chromosome from one bacteria to another. And we published that in Science in 2007. I think philosophically that was one of the most important papers that we've ever done, because it showed how dynamic life was. And we knew once that worked that we actually had a chance, if we could make the synthetic chromosomes, to do the same with those. We didn't know that it was going to take us several years more to get there. In 2008, we reported the complete synthesis of the Mycoplasma genitalium genome, a little over 500,000 letters of genetic code. But we have not yet succeeded in booting up that chromosome. We think in part of its slow growth, and in part cells have all kinds of unique defense mechanisms to keep these events from happening. It turned out the cell that we're trying to transplant into had a nuclease, an enzyme that chews up DNA on its surface, and was happy to eat the synthetic DNA that we gave it, and never got transplantations. But at the time, that was the largest molecule of a defined structure that had been made. And so both sides were progressing. But part of the synthesis, as you'll hear in a minute from Dan, had to be accomplished, or was able to be accomplished, using yeast, putting the fragments in yeast, and yeast would assemble these for us. It's an amazing step forward. But we had a problem because now we had the bacterial chromosomes growing in yeast. So in addition to doing the transplant, we had to find out how to get a bacterial chromosome out of the eukaryotic yeast into a form where we could transplant it into a recipient cell. So our team developed new techniques for actually growing, cloning entire bacterial chromosomes in yeast. So we took the same Mycoides genome that Carol had initially transplanted, and we grew that in yeast as an artificial chromosome. And we thought this would be a great test bed for learning how to get chromosomes out of yeast and transplant them. When we did these experiments, though, we could get the chromosome out of yeast, but it wouldn't transplant and boot up a cell. That little issue took the team 2 years to solve. It turns out the DNA in the bacterial cell was actually methylated, and the methylation protects it from the restriction enzyme from digesting the DNA. So what we found is if we took the chromosome out of yeast and methylated it, we could then transplant it. Further advances came when the team removed the restriction enzyme genes from the recipient Capricolum cell. And once we've done that, now we can take naked DNA out of yeast and transplant it. So last fall, when we published the results of that work in Science, we all became overconfident. We're sure we were only a few weeks away from being able to now boot up a chromosome out of yeast. Because of the problems with Mycoplasma genitalium and its slow growth, about a year and a half ago, we decided to synthesize the much larger chromosome, the Mycoides chromosome, knowing that we had the biology worked out on that for transplantation. And Dan led the team for the synthesis of this over 1 million base pair chromosome. But it turned out it wasn't going to be as simple in the end, and it sent us back 3 months because we had one error out of over 1 million base pairs in that sequence. So the team developed new debugging software where we could test each synthetic fragment to see if it would grow in a background of a wild-type DNA. And we found that 10 out of the 11 100,000 base pair pieces we synthesized were completely accurate and compatible with a life-forming sequence. We narrowed down to one fragment. We sequenced it and found just one base pair had been deleted in an essential gene. So accuracy is essential. There's parts of the genome where it cannot tolerate even a single error, and then there are parts of the genome where we can put in large blocks of DNA, as we did with the watermarks, and it can tolerate all kinds of errors. So it took about 3 months to fix that one, find that error, and repair it. And then early one morning, at 6 a.m., we got a text from Dan saying that now the first blue colonies existed. So it's been a long route to get here, 15 years from the beginning. And so why don't I turn it over to Dan to walk you through the steps that we actually use for synthesizing this chromosome. Then we'll talk a little bit about the watermarks, and then we'll open it for questions. Dan?
Okay, so it was in October of 2007 that we showed that we could put a natural Mycoplasma Mycoides genome in yeast. And then it was 1 year later, in October of 2008, where Carol Artigue sent us all an email and said that she had transplanted that Mycoplasma Mycoides genome out of yeast into Mycoplasma Capricolum recipient cells to produce a Mycoplasma Mycoides cell. At that point, we all knew that all we had to do was synthesize the Mycoplasma Mycoides genome, get it in yeast, and transplant it out, and we would have the world's first synthetic cell. And so we began, so the first thing we do is we have our sequence in front of us at a computer that we want to synthesize, and we partitioned the 1,100,000 base pair genome into 1,100 overlapping pieces that were each chemically synthesized. And all of these pieces were designed so that they overlapped each other, and that facilitates assembly in yeast. And our prior work showed that yeast has this remarkable capacity to take up and assemble as many as 25 pieces, if not more, at once. So we knew that we could use yeast to assemble this genome very easily. So if you imagine the pieces overlap, so that if you have these pieces at the very right side of each of these chemically synthesized pieces, there's a sequence of only 80 bases that has it's the exact same sequence as its adjacent cassette at the left end. And so once these pieces get into yeast, yeast recognizes that these sequences are similar and will assemble them. Now, if we could take all 1,100 pieces at once and add them to yeast cells to make a complete synthetic genome, of course, we would have done that, but we had to come up with a three-stage strategy to do this, and that's what you see up here in this diagram. So in the first stage, we take 10 of these 1,000 base pair sequences, and we assemble them into 10,000 base pair assembly intermediates. And we then take 10 of these at a time again to make 100,000 base pair assembly intermediates. And then at that point, we have 11 pieces of DNA that we then assemble into the complete synthetic genome in yeast. And throughout the whole process, we add another piece of DNA. It's a yeast vector that sort of tricks the yeast cells in thinking that it's one of its own chromosomes. So every time it replicates, it will produce another a copy of the assembly intermediate, or in the very end, a copy of the synthetic genome. So we had the synthetic genome in yeast, and we actually had several different versions of the synthetic genome in yeast. And for months, we were attempting transplantation experiments where we isolate these genomes out of yeast and try to put them into Capricolum recipient cells. But for months, as Craig mentioned, it wasn't working, and ultimately we found out that there was a single base deletion that was responsible for all of our efforts failing. But on March 26th, it was a Friday, and we all felt very confident that we finally were going to get this to work, because for the first time we had a genome that we knew didn't have any lethal mutations. And so we all sweated it out over the weekend, but on Monday morning, very early, we found that we had a blue colony, and we had it was our first synthetic cell. And the colony, it's a blue colony, and you can see it on that over there on top. There's on the very top panel, it says images of Mycoides JCVI SYN 1.0. That's what it looked like.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dan. The only other thing I want to mention at this time is we felt one of the tenets of this field was to make absolutely certain we could distinguish synthetic DNA from natural DNA. Early on, when you're working in a new area of science, you have to think about all the pitfalls and things that could lead you to believe that you had done something when you hadn't, and even worse, leading others to believe it. So we thought the worst problem would be a single molecule contamination of the native chromosome, leading us to believe that we actually had created a synthetic cell when it would have been just a contaminant. So early on, we developed the notion of putting in watermarks in the DNA to absolutely make clear that the DNA was synthetic. In the first chromosome we built in 2008, the 500,000 base pair one, we simply assigned the names of the authors of the chromosome into the genetic code, but it was using just amino acid single letter translations, which leaves out certain letters of the alphabet. So the team, Mike Montague, who I think is here, and Ham and Clyde, actually developed a new code within the code within the code. So it's a new code for interpreting and writing messages in DNA. Now, mathematicians have been hiding and writing messages in the genetic code for a long time, but it's clear they were mathematicians and not biologists, because if you write long messages with the code that the mathematicians developed, it would more than likely lead to new proteins being synthesized with unknown functions. So the code that Mike Montague and the team developed actually puts frequent stop codons, so it's a different alphabet, but allows us to use the entire English alphabet with punctuation and numbers. So there's four major watermarks, all over 1,000 base pairs of genetic code. The first one actually contains within it this code for interpreting the rest of the genetic code. Now, we are waiting anxiously to get our reviews back from Science. We got one back that was, I think, the nicest review we've ever seen. And then I got an email from Barbara Jasny saying that she got the strangest review that Science has ever seen. It was written in DNA code. And she wasn't sure what it said. The initial part was, because we sent the reviewers our new code, the initial part was written in genetic code using our new code, but the reviewer said that their code was actually much better, and the rest of the review was written in their code. So we actually had to translate the DNA code to read the review. But I think Clyde was the first to translate it. But that code, we checked it, would have actually made a bacterial toxin had it been the code we used in the cell. So this has been a fun and fascinating process from the beginning. I told Barbara that we were sending a review back, and she goes, please tell me you didn't write it in DNA code. And we didn't, because we wanted to expedite the review process. So in the remaining information in the watermarks contain the names of, I think it's 46 different authors and key contributors to getting the project to this stage. And we also built in a website address so that if somebody decodes the code within the code within the code, they can send an email to that address. So it's clearly distinguishable from any other species, having 46 names in it, its own web address. We added three quotations because with the first genome, we were criticized for not trying to say something more profound than just signing the work. So we won't give the rest of the code, but we will give the three quotations. So the first is to live, to err, to fall, to triumph, and to recreate life out of life. It's a James Joyce quote. The second quotation is, see things not as they are, but as they might be. So it's a quote from the American Prometheus book on Robert Oppenheimer. And the last one is a Richard Feynman quote, what I cannot build, I cannot understand. So we tried to build a little bit of, because this is much of a philosophical advance as a technical advance in science, we try to deal with both the philosophical and the technical side. The last thing I'll say before turning it over to questions is the extensive work that we've done asking for ethical review, pushing the envelope on that side as well as the technical side. Bob Friedman is here, who's head of our policy group at the Institute. He used to be at the Office of Technology Assessment in Congress. He's had programs funded by the Sloan Foundation, working with MIT and others to look at security aspects, broad representation from our government and other governments attended these panels. This has been broadly discussed in the scientific community, in the policy community, and at the highest levels of the federal government. And even with this announcement, as we did in 2003, that work was funded by the Department of Energy, so the work was reviewed at the level of the White House, trying to decide whether to classify the work or publish it, and they came down on the side of open publication, which is the right approach. We've briefed the White House. We've briefed members of Congress. We've tried to take and push the policy issues in parallel with the scientific advances. So with that, I would like to open it first to the floor for questions. Yes, in the back. Yeah, there's a microphone there.
Could you explain in layman's terms how significant a breakthrough this is, please?
Can we explain how significant this is? I'm not sure we're the ones that should be explaining how significant it is. It's significant to us. We spent 15 years of our lives working on it. To us, perhaps it's a giant philosophical change in how we view life. We actually view it as a baby step in terms of it's taken us 15 years to now to be able to do the experiment we wanted to do 15 years ago on understanding life at its basic level. But we actually believe this is going to be a very powerful set of tools. And we're already starting in numerous avenues to use this tool. We have at the Institute ongoing funding now from NIH in a program with Novartis to try and use these new synthetic DNA tools to perhaps make the flu vaccine that you might get next year. Because instead of taking weeks to months to make these, Dan's team can now make these in less than 24 hours. So when you see how long it took to get an H1N1 vaccine out, we think we can shorten that process quite substantially. In the vaccine area, so Synthetic Genomics and the Institute are forming a new vaccine company because we think these tools can affect vaccines to diseases that haven't been possible to date, things where the viruses rapidly evolve, such with rhinovirus. Wouldn't it be nice to have something that actually blocked common colds? Or more importantly, HIV, where the virus evolves so quickly, the vaccines that are made today can't keep up with those evolutionary changes. Also at Synthetic Genomics, we've been working on major environmental issues. I think this latest oil spill in the Gulf is a reminder. We can't see CO2. We depend on scientific measurements for it, and we see the beginning result of having too much of it. But we can see pre-CO2 now floating on the waters and contaminating the beaches in the Gulf. We need some alternatives for oil. We have a program with ExxonMobil to try and develop new strains of algae that can efficiently capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or from concentrated sources, make new hydrocarbons that can go into their refineries to make normal gasoline and diesel fuel out of CO2. Those are just a couple of the approaches and directions that we're taking. Right here, if we can have a microphone here.
What will be the downside of having a synthetic cell?
So the question is, what is the potential downside of having this? It's not clear there are any. It is powerful technology. This is clearly in the category of dual-use technology, but it's hard to find a technology today that's not dual-use, where it could be used to do harm to somebody or used for public benefit. In discussions and briefing with the administration, the view that evolved was this is perhaps a linear increase in the ability for somebody to do harm, but it's an exponential increase in a tool set that can be used to help humanity. Somebody could potentially try and make specifically harmful agents. That's what some of the early Sloan Foundation studies were directed at, trying to address that. And maybe, Bob, if you want to speak to that a little bit about what the study concluded about the harmful side.
Sure. So as Craig pointed out, it would be possible for someone to use this new technology of synthetic genomics to synthesize a pathogen, a new way to obtain pathogens that can be obtained now from laboratories, from closed facilities. We have a government infrastructure that controls access to really nasty stuff that we would not like to have fall into the hands of a potential bioterrorist. This is a new way to do that, rather than having to find it in nature or steal it. One could synthesize it. Our study looked at approaches to detect whether someone was ordering the chemicals that one would need to synthesize it. Others have looked at this issue as well, and right now there is a notice in the Federal Register that's pending to put in screening procedures to the companies like we use to order these 1,000 base pair pieces of DNA to detect whether somebody was trying to synthesize a pathogen. So, as Craig mentioned, I think we have ways to try and deal with the potential misuse, and it gives us the opportunities now to really take advantage of the potential benefits of the very powerful technology.
Other questions? Yes.
You described this cell as a synthesized cell in your paper, but I'm wondering why you don't call this synthesized life, thinking about this is a single cell creature. Do you just wait to be able to create a synthesized cytoplasm?
So, Clyde, do you want to...
Well, the cell is alive. That's some important thing to understand. These cells, the picture of the colony Dan showed you is a pile of millions of cells sitting there on a plate that have all grown from the original cell that was transplanted with a synthetic genome. So is that an answer to your question? These synthetic cells are alive.
We can't hear you. We call it a synthetic cell. We do start with a living cell that we transform. So this is like all life on the planet. It is derived from other living forms. But it is a new type of cell controlled only by a synthetic genome. So it's not building life from scratch. There's lots of researchers trying to do that to understand early evolution on our planet. People like Jack Sozak at Harvard trying to find what a truly early 3 billion year old life form might have been. This is taking advantage of 3.5 billion years of evolution and using the fact that cells without DNA are dead. So you can't just have a cytoplasm and have a living entity. Life, we found, is incredibly dynamic, changing second to second in these cells. You substitute the synthetic chromosome for the one that's in the cell, and all of a sudden everything in the cell is made from that synthetic chromosome. That's why we're defining it as synthetic life. Why don't we go to the callers?
To ask a question, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first question is from Dan Bernano with USA Today.
Hi, Craig. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah,
I was wondering if any of your team could answer this. You called it the first synthetic cell. The title of the paper is Chemically Synthesized Genome. Is it a synthetic cell or a synthetic genome inside a plain old regular natural cell?
Well, it's not a plain old cell because it didn't exist. Every component in the cell comes from the synthetic genome, but it's sort of splitting hairs in definitions. Our view is because we did it, we get to define it. We're calling it a synthetic cell because everything in the cell derived from that synthetic chromosome. But without the living cell to start with, we wouldn't have had the ability to read the genetic code to start making all these new proteins. So the cell, in it's important, and that's why the study we published in 2007 is so important. By simply changing the chromosome in the cell, it completely transformed one cell into another. I think that's the concept that's probably more radical for people than actually substituting a synthetic chromosome for it. But it's critical because this cell, its lineage is the computer. It's not any other genetic code.
Thanks very much. Are you sticking with this bacteria, or are you looking to do this in a different kind?
This cell is simply for proof of concept and for getting to the minimal genome and the basic understanding. So the next stages, for example, in algae and other areas, are to see if we can make a synthetic algae starting. Now that we know we can make million base pair chromosomes, simple algae are less than 2 million base pairs. So I have no doubt that Dan and the team can easily make a synthetic algae chromosome. I think the biology will be challenging because we have to find an appropriate recipient cell to boot up that chromosome in. So both have to happen in parallel. But the team here, John Glass, will be leading the effort to actually get to the minimal cell now by systematically eliminating genes from our synthetic chromosome.
Thanks very much.
Your next question is from Peter Spotts with the Christian Science.
With the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks for doing that. Dr. Ventner, if I could, I'd like to get you to unpack something that actually you mentioned here and that's also in the press release, but there was a quote in here saying that, as you have pointed out, this is an important step scientifically and philosophically. It certainly changed my views of the definitions of life and how life works. I wonder if you could kind of unpack that for us as kind of a before and after.
Let me give you the simplistic ranges of this. So if you look at the pictures of these cells or any other living entity, they look to most people like fixed units. That cell always looks the same. They can divide and they replicate copies of themselves. But inside is not a static process. If you take out the genetic code, that cell will die very rapidly. If you take out our DNA, our cells will die very rapidly. If you damage our DNA with radiation, we die very rapidly. So you can't have life without the genetic code. So I think what became clear, particularly with the first transplants that Carol Artigue performed, was how fast this information gets read and translated. It's not a day-to-day process, a year-to-year process. It's a second-to-second process. We put in new software. That new software starts getting read and makes a new living cell out of that information. It's dynamic. It's rapid. It's immediate. So everything we see as life forms is a constant information processing, reading the genetic code, making new proteins. Those proteins decay and die. They're replaced by new ones on a continuous basis. That process stops. There's no life. So I think it's just a much more dynamic view, at least for me personally, about how much these microbial cells are information-driven biological machines. Pam or anybody else want to add?
Well, we very frequently use the computer analogy, and I think it's a very good one, because if you purchase a computer at the store, it doesn't do anything unless they install the operating system on it, and its behavior depends on the software that you install. We're in effect designing the software and installing it into a cytoplasm. And the cell then does what we have designed it to do.
Other questions?
Your next question comes from David Viola with Scientific American.
Hi, thanks for doing this. My question is this original colony still alive, and what are the ultimate plans for it?
But it's gone through about a billion steps of self-replication, but it's currently frozen in the freezer right now. Good molecular microbiology practices, you don't keep cells growing indefinitely, but if we need it, we can thaw it out and it will start replicating again. I think we will be using this cell as a starting point for the minimal genome work. We've been waiting for this tool set. If there's a cell museum, we may donate it to it.
And can you talk a little bit more about how you encode all this information with your code within a code within a code? How you go from four letters to, you know, 26 plus punctuation?
Without revealing the code within
yeah.
the code.
Yeah.
One thing is we left this interpretation of this sort of as an exercise to the reader, and we're hoping someone will figure it out, but it's certain groups of nucleotides correspond to English two characters in the Roman alphabet and punctuation.
Gotcha.
It's fairly simple, actually. But it, as Craig said, it was designed in such a way by Michael Montague so that when you put English text into it, it generates very frequent stop codons in the genetic code and won't produce big proteins and can only produce very tiny fragments of proteins. And if anything, and so it's designed to be biologically neutral.
Just as a reminder, the genetic code works in sets of three letters code for a different amino acid.
Mm.
So it wasn't a huge leap from that to adding to the alphabet soup and the punctuation. So
there are 64 triplets, combinations of four letters.
Mm-hmm.
But the genetic code only codes for 20 amino acids, so there's room to code much more.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
You showed us a human genome, and I would like to ask you, give me a comment about the progress of genome research during these 10 years you and other researchers made.
Well, there's not been vast progress, in my view, on the human genome. I think we've now made a lot more progress on the molecular level with these smaller genomes. But it's a good thing to put in context. So 10 years ago, Ham and I and our colleagues were announcing the first draft of the human genome, which we also published in Science at the time. The genome we made today, reporting today, the million base pair letters, if you were looking at a picture of the human chromosomes, this would be so small it wouldn't even show up. So on the order of the 6 billion letters of the human genome, this is a very small baby step today. In the back here.
Hi, Laura Eom, a freelance for Deutsche Welle Radio. I'm just wondering if you can explain what the advantages of having this synthetic genome versus, I know at UC Berkeley, apparently a few years ago, they came up with a synthetic yeast cell, in a sense, not a synthetic yeast cell, but genetically altered yeast cell that then could change sugars into malaria, anti-malaria drug. And I'm wondering if, what's the advantage of having this synthetic process, or is this just another tool besides that can be used to modify organisms so that you can churn out what you want?
It's a good question, one that we've gotten frequently. So it is another tool, but it's an order of magnitude different. Almost everything that anybody has read about of molecular changes in products and plants and bacteria have been less than a handful of genes. An example I give is DuPont spent 10 years and $100 million making a few gene changes to E. coli to go from sugar to a three-carbon propane diol. We've been limited by the techniques for making multiple changes.
more often than what not, what the scientists want to do is eliminate or block metabolic pathways. It seems far more intelligent in the long run to just design the chromosome from the beginning, have in there what you want, and don't have in there what you don't want. It's theoretical at this stage. This is the first little step that now enables that. Up until this paper and this result, this has been a theoretical field. It's now more than theoretically possible, but the most of the changes people will see for the next few years will be the single gene kind of changes until we really perfect not only these techniques but our knowledge. John?
Also, you mentioned that the work that was done at UC Berkeley was done in yeast. So in an organism like yeast or E. coli, there are already extraordinary genetic tools that allow such things as that to be done. But the microbial world is vastly larger than that, and there are many organisms that have properties that might make them useful for industry, for pharmaceuticals, for the environment that we have no genetic tools for. This organism that we work with, no genetic tools at all, essentially, and now this kind of work will enable great discoveries, great advances to be made in those organisms that are otherwise completely intractable.
Other questions over the telephone system?
Your next question is from Stuart Fox with LiveScience.com.
Hello, this is for, I guess, anyone on the panel, and I'm on the phone, so just identify yourself again before you speak. But I was wondering if you could go into a bit more detail about how the cell booted up. I understand how you made the genome, how you inserted the genome into the cell, but once the genome was there, how did the cell know to turn on the DNA, start replicating, and start transcribing?
Harold, you feel like taking that one on? So this is Carol Lateek.
I can try and if somebody wants to complete my answer. So I think the key step here is, in fact, you really need to have a good pair of bacteria. We need to have a compatibility between the donor cells and the recipient cells. What I mean is, in fact, when the donor genome enters the recipient cells, in fact, it will explode the machinery, the cellular machinery, to be activated. So, in fact, for instance, all the transcription machinery, replication machinery, transcription, translation, all those proteins need to recognize this donor genome and activate it. So in our case, because we were working with very closely related species, I think it worked. So, but we need to be careful in the future if we want to, when we're going to start to work with other type of bacteria, we need to keep in mind that they need to be certainly closely related. Right now, we don't know how far genetically, phylogenetically speaking, the donor cell can be, how far phylogenetically speaking the donor and the recipient cells can be.
In fact, that's one of the key areas that we're going to be researching going forward. How universally applicable is this? And even could we have a minimal cellular cytoplasm that just has perhaps a few ribosomes, the ability to make the messenger RNA initially from the genetic code? Because the genetic code, once it starts to be read, will provide all its own necessary components. This is well known to biologists. This is how every virus works. The viral DNA or an RNA goes into the cell. All the viral proteins get made using, hijacking the cellular machinery, and then make multiple copies of itself. So it may take actually very little. Ham and Plant and I and the team were just having a philosophical discussion earlier about how few genes or how many might be needed to get to that stage. I think it will be interesting as the people working on origins of life, people trying to understand these minimal, early possible precursors to life, as those programs proceed in one direction and we proceed from the other, building on top of the evolution of an information system, we might be able to meet somewhere in the middle and have some exciting new tools. Next question, please.
Our next question is from Stephanie Lawrence with the New Zurich newspaper.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm wondering, for which purpose do you think a synthetic genome is better than a microbiome, which is just a little bit genetically altered, where you maybe put one gene out and put a new one in, and then you have a genetically altered microbe. So for which purpose do you think synthetic genomes are better?
Well, that's pretty much the same as the previous question, and obviously the work that caused us to go in this direction in the first place of trying to get to a minimal genome and a basic understanding of cellular life cannot be done with existing molecular biology techniques. So that's probably the best single answer at this point. But John or anybody have anything you want to add?
If I want, John, I'm John Glass, if you wanted to make one protein, say the genes that were used to make human insulin, there it's a fairly simple manipulation. You put one foreign protein into a cell and you produce your product. But imagine I need to reconfigure the whole metabolism of a cell to make it do something that it fundamentally doesn't want to do. For instance, I might need to take away a dozen different genes that are part of pathways that are distributed widely across the cell, and then put in another large piece of DNA that would constitute a new pathway. These are genetic manipulations that are really not amenable to working in using traditional molecular biology, molecular genetics methods.
Was there a question in the room here? Right here? Is the microphone behind you?
You've kind of touched on it before, but can you explain that?
Can you identify yourself for the other?
David Pittman, Chemical Engineering News. Can you explain the process and kind of touch on a little bit? What exactly needs to happen, the steps that you need to do to be able to build, say, a flu vaccine or CO2 capturing algae?
Well, largely the same processes that Dan described, only they're different orders of magnitude. The flu viral constructs are extremely small and don't even need the elaborate techniques that the teams developed for assembly in yeast. Dan has developed some extremely powerful techniques. He described recently in a paper a single pot isothermal reaction, just throwing in three enzymes and oligonucleotides straight from one of the manufacturers, and you can make genes in the multiple KB range. The team actually demonstrated this by making the entire mouse mitochondrial genome, which is 16 KB, if I recall. So in the size range that we were trying to do before, struggling to do even with a small virus, is now just a single pot reaction, and there will probably soon be kits available to do that. Building an entire algae genome is something larger by scale than what we're just reporting today. So they're opposite ends of the spectrum, and most algae are eukaryotes with much larger genomes, maybe on the order of 30 million base pairs. Something like a yeast, which has relatively small chromosomes, they could be made individually and substituted individual. Dan, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, so the largest yeast chromosome is about 2 megabases, so we feel pretty comfortable in knowing that we could probably synthesize a 2 megabase genome and get it into yeast. But then the other side of that is, we've demonstrated that we can transplant genomes that are 1.1 megabases, but can we transplant genomes that are larger than 1 megabases? So these are questions that we hope to get answers to.
Operator, next question.
Your next question is from Herman Escobar with Estado.
Yes, Dr. Venter, can you comment maybe on the possibility of building an entirely new gene from scratch? Going from what you you have now, where you're synthesizing something that already exists in nature, so you have a template to copy from. But would it be possible to, using this genetic software that you developed, that build an entirely new gene from scratch that doesn't exist in nature to perform, you know, some duty that removing CO2 from the air or eating up oil spills or something like that?
A good question, and some people have expressed disappointment we didn't do that this time. But in fact, what you've just asked wouldn't have been possible. It won't be possible without the step we're reporting today. You know, we thought about doing that initially, but imagine if our 99% experimental failure kept going on. We know our funders were getting nervous about adding years after years to this. This was a key experiment by copying something that we know should work in life. Now, knowing that we can synthesize something, transplant it, and get a living cell, it opens things at least to the limits of what reality will be and our imaginations. So we're hoping that it will be possible to do this because we need to be able to do this if we're going to more efficiently capture CO2 using sunlight, if we're going to efficiently make hydrocarbon fuels on the scale necessary to get us weaned off of oil. We need some very dramatic changes in being able to design new cells to do that. There was a question in the back here.
Hi, Laura Iyama with Deutsche Welle Freelance. Again, asking a question. I'm just curious, a lot of people, when something new comes on the scene, you're worried about it getting loose into the environment and possibly out-competing whatever the natural organism is out there. And I'm wondering if there are safeguards that you put into this particular sort of synthetic cell that you've created, so that it will, if it does get out, then it would die off quickly, sort of a suicide mechanism within it.
No, it's an important question, and it's something that we consider a very important aspect, particularly if we're going to have new synthetic algae. We depend on algae for a fair amount of the oxygen we breathe, and it would be bad if that got messed up, I think. So you mentioned suicide genes. There's been, we're just guessing, tens of millions of experiments that have been done taking genes from every species that's known and putting it in laboratory E. coli. And there's never been a problem or accident or escape because there's a chemical dependency of that going in the lab and an antibiotic selection. We work with mycoides in part because they're extremely small cells. They don't exist independently in the environment. They usually have a host. They require very rich media to grow in the lab. This particular one that we work with is a commensal organism in goat populations in the U.S., but we eliminated 14 genes from the genome that, according to the literature, make it not cause problems or infections in goats. We have not injected it to any goats to test that, but for this first step, we were copying essentially a cell that did exist. We eliminated some genes from it. As we eliminate more, it will be truly become only a laboratory strain. But for the future true designs, especially if we're going to try and design something totally new, we will have three or four layers of protection. I think it's essential for the biofuel and bioenergy and making products from carbon dioxide. That any groups doing this have multiple safeguards built in, so we don't have environmental escape. Operator, do you have another?
Your next question is from Margaret Monroe with Ken West News.
Hello, thank you very much. I have a couple of questions. One is pretty simple. It's reported that you spent close to $40 million on this project, and I just want to confirm that. And the second one, it grows out of a release that's come out of a group up here in Canada called ECT Group that's actually calling for a moratorium, or repeating its call for a moratorium on synthetic biology, and they're, you know, looking to the UN to sort of put a lid on this research until, on organisms leaving the lab at least, until there are international rules in place to govern this and oversee it. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
The budget estimates over the time that we've been working on this on the order of $40 million, close to 30 million of that was provided by synthetic genomics to our not-for-profit institute. Some came from the Department of Energy and some came from internal funds. But there'll be multiple comments, I think, because of the philosophical and other natures of this. That particular group likes to make a living off of commenting on what we do, so I don't think there's a lot of value in their approach, but I think what NIH is doing is remarkably reasonable, asking for new guidelines of how to regulate oligonucleotide synthesis companies to make sure nobody's creating new pathogens or recreating old pathogens. I think there's been a lot of discussion with the kinds of policy groups that Bob and others have done, but we look forward to an expanded discussion. We have the Fink report out of the National Academy of Sciences, and I'd like to acknowledge Ralph Cicerone, the president of the Academy, has been able to join us today. So I think there'll be lots of sources of ideas and discussion going forward.
Thank you. Thanks.
Next question, please.
Your next question is from Logan Wardo with Popular Mechanics.
Hi, it's Logan Ward. Thank you for taking my question. It's several short questions. What did you name this new synthetic cell? Is it a new species? Can you patent it? And if not, how do you protect the intellectual property rights?
Who wants to take on the naming question? Dan?
JCVI SIN 1.0.
And mycoides.
Yeah, Mycoplasma mycoides JCVI SYN 1.0.
And it's a new strain. It's not a new species.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided continuing the computer analogies to use software nomenclature, because you can imagine as we start removing genes systematically from the cell, each new chromosome we create needs a separate designation, and there'll be lots of versions of that. There's been lots of controversy recently, even a court ruling about whether naturally occurring DNA is patentable. This comes up from time to time. There was the Chakrabarty decision of the Supreme Court quite some decades ago that said discovering new bacteria or other cells were patentable. I've never been quite comfortable with making discoveries of discovering existing life forms and claiming patents on them, but I think if we ever had an argument for something that was human-derived by starting with code in the computer and building it, I think we have a good case for a whole new approach to this. We consider there was a lot of inventiveness, a lot of inventions that went into this, Synthetic Genomics on our behalf has filed multiple patents on various stages of this work.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is that it, operator? Or?
Your next question is from Dan Bergano with USA Today.
Question with the naming thing. Thanks very much.
At this time, there are no further telephone questions.
Terrific. Thank you very much, operator. Is anybody in the room feel they didn't get a chance to ask? I'd also like to acknowledge Mr. K.T. Lim, who flew in from Malaysia just to be here today. He's been a great friend and one of the key investors in synthetic genomics. So, K.T., we're delighted to have you here. If there's no further questions, I'd like to thank you very much, and thank you, team. So.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.